Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we talk about taste. And today, we're actually taking it out of the studio adjacent to Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we are in the middle of the American Museum of Natural History, who has mounted this incredible new exhibit called Our Global Kitchen, which is a 360-degree, throughout all the ages, exhibit about food, built around six essential questions that span how we are going to feed the planet, how important food is for culture and celebration, and then some of the issues about sustainability and diversity and decisions that we make about agriculture. I'm really, really excited to be here. It's a lot of fun to walk through, and it's going to take a lot more time than we have today, but we are fortunate to be guided by one of the co-curators of the museum, Mark Norell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're so excited to be here. We've actually never taken the show out of the studio before. Yeah. So usually we're in Bushwick, Brooklyn, attached to Roberto's. But here we're in this world of food, of taste, of really our global kitchen. Tell us a little bit about how the exhibit came to be. Why now? What made the museum look to such a major mounting of a food exhibit?
Well, I mean, the museum does a combination of things. We do both, you know, shows about kinds of animals, about cultures, but we also do, you know, kind of thematic shows about big problems and big ideas. And we've previously done shows on water, shows on climate change, and it just seemed natural that, you know, food is just something that is so universal and so necessary and so vital for our lives that we sort of attack this really big problem and try to bring some of the interesting things and some of the issues to the forefront in the exhibition format.
So you said food is a big problem. Let's talk about that a little bit. I understand the show's been arranged around six essential questions.
Right.
We could call them problems or challenges or
Sure. Opportunities.
What were they?
Well, I mean, really, I look at it more as just a journey through the food system because some of them are challenges, some of them aren't. I mean, so we start with growing, then we go to harvesting, then, you know, marketing and transporting and moving, then to cooking, finally to eating, and then finally we end it with, you know, celebrating.
Celebrating, one of our favorite things to do about food. So we're standing right now in front of a marketplace. Can you tell me what I'm looking at and describe it a little bit for people listening?
Yeah, you're looking at a marketplace in the Valley of Mexico, what's Mexico City today, as it would have looked right after the first contact with Europeans. So shortly after the fall of 1512. And I think that when you look at it, you know, you see this, like, you know, array of all these different, you know, vegetables, animals, all kinds of things.
I see, but lots of different peppers and corn,
right,
and potatoes and apples, no, tomatoes.
Yeah, so. And if you just look around, you can say, well, look, you know, this really forms, I mean, so many of these things are so familiar and form the basis of many of the things that we consider to be European cuisine today. You know, everything from the tomatoes to, you know, we have squashes back there, we have chilies, you know, we have all these different kinds of things. But other things are unfamiliar. I mean, for instance, I mean, nobody in Europe has eaten iguanas like what they're hanging out with.
No, but pheasants, maybe wild boar, but not iguanas, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, first, I'd just like to talk, to me, I mean, this graphic really much sums up the whole, you know, food issue today. Because what it is, it's how much food is lost at several different stages in the developed world and the undeveloped world. So basically, agricultural production in high and middle-income countries is the same as it is in low-income countries. So the total amount of food that's produced is the same. Then in high-income countries, the amount lost is much less because that we have refrigerators, we have roads, we have transit to be able to you know, save a lot of food before it goes to market. As far as the processing and packaging thing, again, it's about the same between the two different countries. Wholesale versus retail, about the same. The big difference is just in at the consumption stage. It's
wow,
in waste. I mean, that almost you know, four times as much food is wasted at the consumption stage, at the consumer stage, in high and middle income countries than low income countries. So
food waste is one of those big challenges, I guess.
It's a huge challenge. I mean, even here we're standing next to, you know, a cube full of just different, you know, food kinds of things. A family of four in the United States throws away about 1,600 pounds of food each year.
Isn't that amazing? I'm looking at a glass cube full of boxes of bran flakes and crushed tomatoes and granulated sugar and all sorts of stuff, and this is equivalent to that amount that someone throws away. Wow, it's three times the sizes of me. Four times. Five. Amazing. And it's adjacent here to this beautiful display kitchen.
Right.
And it's got our favorite word attached to it, taste. So tell us what happens here.
Well, this is one of the great challenges of building a show like this at the museum. How could you have a show about food without having a kitchen?
Indeed.
But at the same time, I mean, complying with New York City health regulations as well as our own regulations about having food in the galleries because of pests and that kind of thing. And trying to just, you know, vent it to the outside from the bowels of the museum was really a big issue. But we were able to do it. And what we have is that we have food demonstrations in here. And every 2 weeks, we have a different theme. I mean, we started out because when the show opened a couple weeks ago, it was sort of the prime of apple season. So we started out with apples. The theme right now, it's written up here, is bread.
Okay.
So, you know,
the
we have
staff just, of life.
Yeah, we just have tastings of these things each day.
Amazing. And this must be the first kitchen that's ever been put in a museum, probably anywhere, I would imagine. Working kitchen.
Well, I mean, there are... For display purposes,
Part of the exhibit.
Yeah,
obviously, there are restaurants and cafes and those sorts
of course,
things.
Right, of course, to my knowledge, it is, yeah.
Amazing.
So
here, actually, outside the kitchen, we're surrounded by different examples of utensils and technologies related to food. And this table here is one of my favorite parts of the exhibit. We have to explain it a little bit.
Sure. Well, it's basically, you know, what we have is we have a virtual table, which is a flat surface, and it goes through the steps, both the recipe steps and the culinary steps, but also some little anecdotal kinds of things about scientific kinds of things about what happens when you cook. So we feature four dishes, peanut or groundnut soup from Africa, poached eggs with hollandaise sauce, grilled salmon and peach salad, and tamales. So you can, you know, interact with this.
And you stand here, right, and it starts, it's like you're cooking. It's amazing. I mean, without getting your hands dirty. But you can hear everything. You watch the water boil. You add the egg yolks. Right now, which one are we making here?
We're making the hollandaise sauce. Right now.
So which experienced home cooks, you know, sort of are intimidated by.
Yeah, it's getting easier and easier, though, now because you can just sit with your iPad and go on YouTube and learn how to cook anything.
Kind of
step
amazing.
By step.
Well, this is like a giant iPad instead of the mini. It's the macro. So how... one of the things that I think is remarkable about this exhibit, and there's tons to do and interact with and read. It takes a lot of time, really, to grasp everything. One of the remarkable things is you really try to include the entire world, and the Global Kitchen is a big kitchen. Talk to me a little bit about the process of curating it logistically, literally. I mean, how do you decide what's here and what's not?
It is really tough. You know, I mean, making a show like this is very much akin to making a movie. I mean, it's when we start out, we start with just kind of a one-page kind of thing, and then...
The treatment, right?
And then if that goes okay, then it gets tested out on the floors to see if people would actually want to come and see a show like that. Then after the treatment, then it goes into if it passes that step, it goes into a phase called incubation, which is sort of just, you know, developing general concepts, and then basically, you know, the equivalent of a script sort of thing is put together. And then from that, then we start working with the the writers, the designers, the exhibition department in developing the equivalent of like a shooting script, which is like an edited down version of it. And that's the hardest part, especially with a topic like food, you know, because it's so big. It's not the kind of thing like you're, you know, you have the gallery, you know, God, what are we going to put in there? I mean, in this case, it's stuff is, well, what are we going to throw out? Because we can only cover just little tiny bits of this and stuff. And knowing also that our audience now is very international. I mean, 50% of our visitors are international tourists these days.
And some of the visitors are little people, and some of them are older.
We try to really go for a very, you know, global approach. And we also try to go for an approach which is very much layered. So it'll appeal as much to a six-year-old as it will to, you know, somebody who barely speaks English who's in their 80s, for instance. You know, so everyone can get something out of it, even if it's just an aesthetic experience of walking through and looking at things. So it's got to be both beautiful and informative. So
great. Well, let's walk through and look at this wall over here, which I think is very interesting. And this is the wall of cookbooks, which sometimes we don't always think of necessarily as being part of the food system. But in fact, so many people learn about food and learn how to cook through them. And I can't imagine how you would take all what must be 100 billion cookbooks and choose the ones that are here. But was there some overarching idea behind this?
You know, we tried to go for some of the very iconic ones, like, you know, the Escoffier book and stuff.
Of course.
And we tried to go for some of the funny stuff, like the old joy of cooking from the 1960s when that they still had recipes for, and this is actually an illustration from it and stuff, for squirrels and for possum and stuff.
Perfect. How to skin a squirrel. I see James Beard's American Cookery there.
Yeah,
we're proud
James
to
Beard,
have him
of course.
Up there.
Of course, you know, this book was very, you know, influential in the 1960s and stuff. It was one of the first Chinese cookbooks.
And that's Pei Mei's Chinese Cookbook.
Right. So we just, you know, went for a little bit of stuff all
like
over
a
the
tasting
world.
Menu. Right, yeah. Right. Well, that's the part that's fun is discovering, you know, seeing things you recognize or learning about new things you don't know at all. Right next to that, of course, right next to these traditional how to skin a squirrel illustrations, you've got the high-tech aspect that has come to food, the molecular gastronomic world. I don't think that if you had done this show 5 years ago, there would have been a canister of liquid nitrogen illustrated as part of it in the food.
I certainly don't think so. You know, places like Alinea, places like that, really changed the game. I think it's kind of like, it's an aspect of food which it's real, you know, presentation's always been important, you know, less so in American food, but in Japanese food, especially in French food. But the whole idea of making food, like, as art pieces is a pretty new idea within Western cuisine, at least. And
sure.
Stuff, so,
it adds to the sort of cultural relevance in some ways of it.
Right.
Smell-o-vision, or I don't know what you call these things. I'm looking at a box that has what looks like a horn or something with holes in a glass case, and it says, push here to smell cinnamon.
Yeah, you have to get your nose right on it. But
okay, now, what is that? How does that work?
Well, actually, there's an oil that volatilizes in this machine. So we have these little smelling stations throughout the gallery and stuff, just to, you know, I mean, so much of taste, so much of food in general is smell. So,
of course, amazing.
I mean, there's very few things that really taste bad or smell bad that taste good. I mean, there's a few exceptions.
Right, some cheeses maybe.
Cheeses, durian.
Natto in Japan. And then there's this representation here. We're walking into the eat section, let's say, of different dining rooms and ways that people eat and what constitutes a meal. From ancient Rome.
And on the way in, we have this, which I think that people are really responding to, and it's a way that you can share your own meals.
Oh, really?
Yeah, by getting that hashtag celebrate food on Instagram, and this gets repopulated every now and again, and you can.
So it's a touch screen that allows us to see a typical Italian meal in the early 1940s. My father, Ralph, is lower center. Wow.
And, you know, people can.
And that is someone in front of a giant turkey about to eat a whole turkey.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. Artichokes.
And, you know, there's new ones coming up all the time, and some of them are pretty funny. This one is an Indian family. It says, Desi Thanksgiving with Tandoori Chicken. And it faux forever.
Wow. So take pictures of your food and tweet them out. Well, what do you call Instagramming? Instagram them with the hashtag #CelebrateFood. Fascinating. While people go and find something they just ate, why don't we take a quick break? We are at the American Museum of Natural History with the co-curator of the Global Kitchen exhibit, Mark Norell. We'll be right back. Thanks.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
We are back at the Museum of Natural History with co-curator Mark Norell. So we are now in the dining room, let's say, or the dining rooms of the exhibit, where I see an ancient Roman reclining setting here. Yeah. Uh-huh. What's going on there? What are we eating, I wonder?
Well, yeah, we're just trying to look at, you know, cuisine through the ages. This is the dining room of Livia Drusilla, the first empress of Rome. And this was a typical meal from her time, which I think looks pretty different than what most people would think was an Italian meal today or a Roman meal, because we have things like sea urchins, olives, which are still there, figs, you know, eggs, and a kind of soup that's made out of different herbs like thyme and salted fresh cheese and things like that. It almost looks like a sag paneer.
Right, it does. Well, of course, ancient Rome, we wouldn't have tomatoes, which we think of as Italian. I don't see pasta here, which is probably for poor people or something.
Pasta was actually an invention from Central Asia and China that came across the Silk Road at a later time.
There you go. So very different. And then here's a more recognizable dining room, perhaps, where we're all sitting up at a table.
Right. Jane Austen.
Jane Austen.
And, you know, the whole story of, you know, ice cream and stuff, and how that it was something only for the super wealthy back in those days, the people who actually, you know, could afford to have ice houses where they could keep blocks of ice all summer, you know, buried under straw to be able to, you know, make this really sort of egalitarian dessert today.
Right, which you get for, right, a dollar at a truck on the street.
Refrigeration and ice.
Amazing. Right. And then lastly over here, a more exotic looking
This is Kublai Khan.
Khan's dining room. And what's he eating? I see little smelts, fried fish.
Fried fishes. As someone who still, you know, works in Mongolia today, I mean, basically the dish on the upper right, which is a big chunk of steamed mutton, is something that Mongolians still, is one of their staples.
Amazing. And lastly, we have these dioramas of meals from around the world today, I guess.
This is actually that the Iceman, Utsi, his final meal.
I see all sorts of new theme dinners in New York this year because of this exhibit. Iceman cometh dinner.
Right.
So, frozen dinners, look at that.
Yeah,
vegetarian dinners.
Dried fruit, dried meat, and even bread on the inside of his stomach when he died. 5,000 years ago.
Amazing.
And then we have a meal depicting what Gandhi ate.
Oh. A vegetarian Indian meal. Yeah.
Vegetarian Indian meal, but I mean, it looks good.
Yeah, it does look really good.
And this over here, this giant meal, is Michael Phelps' breakfast when he was in training.
A giant bowl of porridge, eggs, French toast, pancakes.
Many reports say that he was consuming up to 9,000 calories a day when he was in peak training form.
Wow. Sometimes I have days like that too, only I'm not training for anything. And the celebration, I guess we end here, as you said, the journey of food with celebration. And I think that that's where a lot of us like to like to be around food. Certainly, Heritage Radio is all about the celebration of food, understanding, of course, the with the awareness that there are all these other things that lead to that, make that possible.
Yeah, and even with the celebration of food, I mean, that there's some things which are almost universals. I mean, just about every culture in the world has a harvest festival. I mean, whether it's, you know, Western Europe, whether it was Native American cultures here, whether it's the Chinese Moon Festival and stuff, or Mid-Autumn Festival and stuff. So that's a real universal. So we talk about that a little bit, and we have some different, you know, mooncake molds and these masks that people in the Indo-Pacific, you know, put on yams and everything during their harvest festival and stuff.
I'm telling you, the theme parties are just rolling around in my head. So we are standing in a symbolic cornfield. Well, this actually looks like there's corn growing on either side of us.
This whole thing is a journey through the food system. So, you know, growing and how people grow food and what they grow is just basically the ground zero for what we end up eating later on. So,
of course. So what aspects do you think in the growth of food? I see now we're looking at hybridization, we're looking at yield, we're looking at all the questions that sort of face us, those people interested in sustainability of agriculture, and yet growing is the most basic, primitive thing, food. So,
well, it's so primitive and so basic that, you know, every single food crop we have, or at least 99% of the food crops we have been altered by ourselves in some way. I mean, even things, you know, we talk about cod. You know, cod in the 1800s were up to 6 feet long.
Wow.
And today the average size of a cod is about 18 inches. And just by selecting for larger and larger fish, that the entire population has gotten smaller and started to breed at smaller sizes.
Wow.
So even though we don't directly manipulate it through breeding and stuff, just our harvesting practices and stuff have very much changed the character of the available food.
So. Hmm. And so with the is this exhibit advocating for any particular approach, or are you really just trying to be a neutral source of information about these different decisions that we make about food?
We don't really advocate anything. I mean, that's not our job, or, you know, our general thought is to advocate certain positions. What we do is we try to ask questions, and we try to provide information, and we try to provide information that's way beyond what you would find like on Wikipedia and things like that. We try to give numbers that are real numbers that we'll stand behind, so people can just leave the show with a greater appreciation and then make decisions for themselves.
I'm looking at a number right now that 900 million people use cassava as sort of a staple food.
Yeah.
Right? We think of rice, we think of wheat, but we don't always think about cassava.
The planet.
That's amazing, and I bet most of the people listening have never had cassava.
Yeah, exactly. So.
And this is a giant cassava root that's about as tall as Ashley, our producer, is here. Wow.
And I think this is interesting, too, because it just shows how much that we've modified food, because chickens that, you know, we have today are derived from an animal from Southeast Asia called the red jungle fowl. Red jungle fowl lay 12 eggs a year. So they lay one egg each lunar cycle, like, you know, many animals do, or, you know, many animals do, including like ourselves, basically. But then the red jungle fowl was bred into all the different breeds of chickens that we have today, which can lay one egg a day.
Wow.
So it just, you know, shows how pervasive it is.
And that's long before genetic modification. That's long before any understanding. That was just about...
That's another thing, too, that we try to, you know, point out, that, you know, what we did with hybridization and sort of, you know, crossbreeding of different plants and things is genetic modification. That today's GMOs are just using different techniques to do something that we've been doing for millennia.
Right. Why anyone would necessarily want to create a square watermelon, which I'm looking at three examples of, I'm not quite sure. It's probably not genetic modification, physical modification.
Physical modification. These are actually grown in polycarbonate boxes to make them square. But it just really, and they're very expensive as well. It just appeals to the whole Japanese aesthetic of nicely wrapped things.
So of course.
You can, you know, buy these and they're
neatly
beautifully wrapped and things and given away as presents. So.
Beautiful. So here's one of those giant cod you were talking about, a 6 foot cod down to 18 inches. That makes me sad a little bit. It just seems like it's interesting to hear that there is an evolutionary aspect to it, not just that we've taken all the big ones away and don't let them grow.
Right. And I think that, I mean, I would love to eat one of those. I can just imagine sort of like a pig roast, but with a giant fish in the middle of the table.
The whole fish from nose to fin. Potatoes, another thing that we sort of don't realize, you know, if you know three kinds of potatoes, that's a lot these days. And here I see over a dozen different varieties, and I know there are many, many more.
Yeah, there's many, many more. And I think another thing that people don't realize is that potatoes, just like tomatoes, are something which is indigenous to the Americas. So before European contact, potatoes were unknown in Europe and,
right.
And in Asia. And I think it's kind of interesting also that just, you know, I've been working in Asia now for well over the last 20 years. And when I first started working in China, nobody ate potatoes. Now, because potatoes really grow in pretty marginal soils like Ireland and things like that, they're grown all over northern China. And there's a lot of recipes have come up that
with potatoes in them. And you don't think of Chinese potatoes.
Right, there's a restaurant in town,
Grand Sichuan, that has a potato dish I always order just to surprise people.
They don't know what they're eating, or why, would never expect it. In northern China now, I mean, there's whole restaurants just devoted to potatoes, and there's a whole cuisine that's been developed around them.
Amazing. So the potatoes lead us right into the panel on taste. It's all about flavor. It says, once people learn to modify their foods through selective breeding, one obvious goal was to create pleasing flavors, whether by growing an extra spicy pepper or super sweet apple or carrot. And one of the themes throughout, it seems to me, with all the different examples of peppers and potatoes and even in the marketplace, is this question of diversity of things. And what that contributes. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, especially as we look at preserving the food system into the future, a huge amount of the calories that we consume as humans basically come from three crops. You know, it's like rice, wheat, and corn.
Right.
And that, you know, as we learned in the, and a lot of those are even monocultures within that. So as we learned in the 1850s with the Irish potato famine, that can be not always a good thing. If some, you know, huge blight or something all of a sudden hits and wipes out the world's wheat crop, for instance, it would cause tremendous political upheaval and everything else. So, you know, one of the things that people who are, you know, both farmers, nutritionists, and policymakers are looking at is just increasing the base diversity of the types of food we eat. So, you know, we, like the cassava thing back there, I mean, that's something that, you know, already 1/7 of the people on the planet are eating it and stuff, but most of us have never heard of it.
Right.
It's just globalizing the food that we eat and trying to incorporate new and different kinds of things into our diets.
Hmm. And we can't leave here without thinking about, I'm going to head.
We should talk about this.
The Scoville Index. So
yeah.
I see a bunch of little and not so little hot peppers that look scary to me.
We're looking at a variety of peppers from basically ones that don't contain any capsaicin, which is the ingredient which makes peppers hot. And those are things like bell peppers. Hotness in peppers is judged on the determination of Scoville units. So the higher the Scoville index, the hotter the pepper is. And some peppers that we think of, you know, are pretty hot. Probably the hottest peppers that most people in the audience have ever eaten is a habanero, which
right.
is pretty hot. Okay, that's 250,000 to 500, half a million Scoville units. But things like the Trinidad Moruga scorpion and the Botchacala are 2 million. So that they're, you know, 4 or almost 10 times hotter than a habanero.
I can't even comprehend what that would be.
Well, the Botchacala, it's actually been weaponized.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
So chemical warfare through peppers.
Yeah, well, you know, mace, is spray mace is capsaicin.
Pepper paste, right.
Yeah,
and pepper spray.
We grew some of these because we couldn't find them in markets and we wanted to have accurate ones. So we grew these on the roof of the exhibition department this summer and then cast them from the peppers that we grew. And these are so hot, you know, we'd taste little bits of it. People would take them home to put in cooking. You actually have to handle these with gloves, because you can absorb the oils through your fingers and your fingers start stinging.
Oh my gosh, amazing, just amazing. So speaking of growing, we are looking at things actually growing here in the exhibit in these vertical garden.
Yeah.
Can you explain this a little
this
bit?
This is a hydroponic garden, and this is built by a company called Window Farms in Brooklyn, which have this pretty novel technique for, you know, growing things, which that it's, what it is, it's a series of vertical cones, and then water is pushed up through hoses, and the water has different nutrients in it. Then the water drips back down into a reservoir, and then it goes back up and through again. And, you know, I think they're great. I'm actually getting one for my office because it's a great thing for New Yorkers who want to like to cook,
have
to be able to grow.
Fresh salad and some herbs.
Yeah, you know, some fresh rosemary, some basil, some chives, things
so
like
lush
that.
And beautiful. It's remarkable because this is a pretty dark internal environment
yeah.
that we're in.
On the 77th Street, or, you know, on the Columbus Avenue facade where the Columbus Avenue entrance is, we have a big installation of these that covers an entire glass wall that faces Columbus Avenue. And it's really just in the few weeks that it's been in, you know, the plants have grown profusely and stuff. So it's
amazing. So how long do people have to come see this amazing exhibit?
Well, the exhibit's going to be here until the first week of August 2013.
Oh, so a lot of time. And you're also doing all sorts of programming around that. There's the tastings in the kitchen, obviously, but also some talks and some panel discussions.
Yeah, we have panel discussions. We have cooking demonstrations. We have a whole series of public programs just developed around the show that includes everybody from chefs to farmers to policymakers to people concerned with everything from, you know, pesticides, GMOs, animal rights. And we try to present a really balanced opinion on this through, you know, having people which represent a diversity of views.
Well, thank you, Mark. The show is up until the first week of August in 2013, so you better come and see it. You can't complain that you didn't have enough time, and there's all sorts of programming going on around it. There are panel conversations and cooking demonstrations and those tastings in the Tasting Kitchen. Next week, we welcome Francis Lam, who many of you probably follow on Twitter. If you don't, you should, because he's thought-provoking and provocative kind of guy. A great food writer. He was at Guilt Taste. He was at Gourmet before that. And we're really excited to have him on the show. In the meantime, if you're listening to us on a podcast on iTunes and you have any questions about the show or perhaps questions for Mark Norell, please email them to us at info@heritageradionetwork.org or tweet them to us at TasteMattersHRN. In the meantime, have something delicious and run to the museum to see that exhibit.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.